For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're in this section of Genesis, which is just so awesome. Really, Genesis 12 through 22 focuses on Abraham. And the narrator, in telling the biography of Abraham's life, really pays very close attention to two things. One, what is God doing uniquely to advance his purpose for history? And then the second is, what does it mean to be a human and to learn how to cooperate with that plan in real time and in real life? And the passage that we're studying here tonight, Genesis 15, is really so foundational to our whole understanding of what does it mean to live before God. The example that we see in Abraham in this chapter is so important that it is cited numerous times in the New Testament as a challenge and an example for us as Christians. And so tonight we want to unpack why it's so important. Let's take a look just at the opening verse here. In verse 1, he says, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great.'" And I want to unpack this because the context actually is pretty important, but I want to take a step back before we do. Again, that we see in Abraham throughout the Old Testament and definitely spilling into the New, a model of what it means to live the life of faith. And so with that in view, we're just asking this question, what does faith look like? And to get an understanding of why is the lesson of Abraham so important, Paul says in Romans chapter 15, verse 4, he says, "Whatever was written in earlier times," namely he's talking here about the Old Testament, "was written for our instruction so that through perseverance and the encouragement of scriptures, we might have hope." So there's the challenge to you right here, that this story of Abraham's life is not just an interesting factoid of history, but rather is something that God has preserved in his word because his life speaks in such a direct way to our lives. Let's figure out why that is. In chapter 12, verse 1, which sets the real context for what happens in chapter 12, God approaches Abram and he says to him, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, "Go from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation and I will bless you." And so Abraham is called to go, and that's what Abraham does. He goes, he leaves Haran, this place north of Palestine, and he follows God's lead right into the land of Canaan. And while he is there, he gives witness to God. Multiple times it says that he built up altars, memorials to the work of God, and which will call attention to people. Why is this thing here? Well, it's because let me tell you the story about how good God is. And he says that he walked with the Lord and he prospered just as God said that he would prosper. But there is more to the story than simply that, because it says after these things, and these things relate to the incident that we talked about last week where Abram's nephew Lot, because they had become affluent, both Lot and Abram, because God had said that he would bless them, and he did, their herds became so large that they could no longer graze in the same areas. And so Lot took the fertile field in the region just north around the Jordan River. And in that context, got taken up in a little bit of internecine rivalry with Palestinian overlords, and was taken into captivity. So Abram shakes loose with his 380 trained men and rescues Lot from his imprisonment. And you begin to realize that this land that God has sent Abram into is a fearful place. And the thinking that he is somehow stuck between the promise that God makes, "I'm going to make of you a great nation, and this land is for your descendants." And, you know, it sounded like a pretty good sales pitch there in chapter 12. And then he goes and he begins to see what's really going on here and realizes, okay, the people who are in the land are really rugged. These are people who have a really debauched religious system. They're warlike. It's just not that easy living here. And besides which, I've been here now for about a decade, and that promise about, you know, that nation coming forth from me, that's not really happening either. And Sarah is just as barren today as she was in the days that we lived in Haran, and before that in Ur, the Chaldees. And so there is a bit of a disconnect in Abram's mind between taking God seriously with his promise, which clearly he did because he was willing to move on the basis of it, and that yet his experience up to this point tells him that none of these things are coming to pass. And so Abram is beginning to wonder, and that's why God has to come to him and say, do not fear. Do not fear. Well, he is fearing, and the reality is that significant doubts are beginning to enter into his mind, which is kind of the next step that comes after fear. In verse 2, Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Since you have given me no offspring, one born in my house is my heir. Well, we know that's an interesting little piece of history here, because this is one of the reasons why we can date the event of Abraham's life. There are many lines of evidence, but this is one of the significant ones we have uncovered from the region that Abraham migrated into in Palestine, numerous cuneiform tablets, that's that weird slashed alphabets that were done among the Sumerians, the Akkadians of the early or the late 3rd millennium BC when Abraham was living there. And it includes things like this legislation that says if you have no children, the oldest servant, male servant in your household becomes your heir. So when Abraham says that, he really is plugging into a legal system that was well known to his time. Doubts begin to emerge. You know, we wonder, did I hear you right when you said that I was going to be the father of a great nation? I mean, really, makes me wonder, maybe you were saying something else. Maybe I didn't get the story straight. Maybe, can we really say that God, you can really deliver on your promises? Maybe I did hear it right, but it's been so long and nothing's changed. We wonder, how could it be? So things begin to emerge in the heart and the mind of Abram at this point. And I think that you and I can totally relate to Abraham. All of us can. We all have a struggle in faith, don't we? We do. We wonder sometimes. It's easy to become suspicious of God. Are your promises just empty platitudes, wishful thinking for me? I wonder, do you really have a plan for my life that is good? We wonder about whether or not God is interested in and will cooperate with our agenda. And so there's that kind of a struggle of faith. And we wonder, you know, is God going to be with me in the things that I'm pursuing? We think about the many setbacks that are always a part of the life of faith and especially of service. And we wonder, is the price that we have to pay, the failures that are involved, is it really worth the cost? And this becomes also a crisis of faith. Is the whole project that God has called us to really worth the amount of energy that we have to put into it? And then there is just sometimes that intangible sense of, you know, the real things that I experience are physical objects in front of me, the physical world that I live in. And the whole God thing just seems a bit abstract, seems a bit less real. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, you know you do. We all struggle in this area. And Abraham was struggling in this same way. And so what we need to do is we really need to think about seriously, what is God doing in this passage that would advance Abraham's faith in such a way that Abraham could be put forth in the New Testament as an example of faith to us? So just think about that for a bit. You know, as we are moving through this passage, you think about, what are my struggles of faith? Am I one who has really become sort of in my heart suspicious of God and God's intent? Am I one who is sort of giving ground and giving way to the whole project of being a servant of God because I've experienced setbacks and difficulties in my life, and so I'm just kind of sort of moving back into my own private world and away from the things that God has called me to? That's a crisis of faith. Have I become suspicious of God's goodness? Yeah. Well, let's press on. Abraham asks a very specific question. God answers. Verse 4. Then the Lord spoke to Abram, saying, "This man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body. He shall be your heir." And God took Abraham and he said, "Look toward the heavens and count the stars if you can." And so he says, "Shall your descendants be?" And just I can imagine that out in the plain there in the land of Canaan, and on a dark night, and there's no ambient light from Chicago or Cleveland or whatever, and just pure dark, and then the innumerable shimmering lights, and God saying, "Try to count them: 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9." You know, and he finally gives up after a bit, and God's like, "Boom, dude, so many that you can't even count them. That's how many descendants you are going to have." Wow, pretty sweet. So now we come to the foundational question of faith. What is God doing? God is renewing the promise that he made in chapter 12. He says, "I'm going to make you a great nation." And now in chapter 15, he's reminding him of that promise. And so he's in a sense saying, "Go back to go," in the Monopoly game language. Go back to where you started. Let's think this thing through together. I get that you have fears. I understand that. I get that the place that I sent you is a lot rougher than anything you might have envisioned. But that doesn't mean that I was insincere in my promise and my pledge to you. So let's go right back to that foundation. And then things get interesting. Abraham now really just overtly expresses his doubt. And he says in verse 8, "How may I know?" Imagine this. God is reaffirming this promise, and he's weighing in his own heart, here's what God has said, and here's everything that I experienced, and there is this crisis moment for him. I think a moment of real honesty where he says directly to God himself, "How do I know this? How do I know that this is so?" Well, God's not afraid of Abram's questions. He's not afraid of yours either. They matter to him. And to be honest with God is always an important place to start. So this is where he starts. How do I know? So what does God do? God goes from making the promise to making a contract and a specific vow. Let's read on. He says in verse 9, God said, "Bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, a young pigeon, partridge and a pear tree," whatever. Abram brought all these things to the Lord and he cut them in half. Each half was placed opposite the other. Weird. The sun was going down and a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, in relation to your question, how may I know? He says, "Know for sure that your descendants will be strangers in a strange land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will judge the nation, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age." Wow. weird stuff. In the fourth generation, he says, they will return here for the iniquity of the Amorite. These are people living in the land, is not yet complete. God's not done with these people, so you can't have the land. At sunset, as it became dark, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between the carcasses. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river Euphrates. And so this is interesting. What is going on here? This is called old school contract. We have lots of examples, again, from this region of the world that dates way back into the end of the third millennium BC, the end of the 2000s BC. And one of the things that we know from that era is how they made contracts with one another. And it is exactly as it is described for us in this text. So God has made a promise. And now he's taking that promise into a formal contract, into terminology and the language that Abraham himself would understand, so that he gets the point that God is serious. And so in the ancient world, you would take animals of value and you would literally hack them in half. And you would set their carcasses opposite each other with a pathway in the middle. And the people who are entering into a contract with one another would be on opposite ends of this thing, and they would meet in the middle. And they would swear vows to one another. Here's what I'm going to do to keep my side of this deal, and should I fail, may what has happened to these animals happen to me. So they were pretty serious when it came to cutting a deal. You laugh. That's exactly where that comes from. To cut a contract has this ancient context to it. And so God is just telling Abraham, I'm swearing to you, verse 18, your descendants, I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great Euphrates. That's your descendants' land. And may it be done to me as it has been done to these animals, should I fail to deliver on that promise. Amazing. Here's another amazing part. Who has the obligation in this contract? Remember what happened with Abraham. It says that he was incapacitated. He's not in a place where he's going to get up and he's going to walk in the middle of this row of carcasses. It is the Lord and the Lord only, it says in verse 18, who made a covenant with Abram. It doesn't say that Abram made a covenant with God. It's not a two-way street. It's a one-way thing, and it is God and he alone who makes the oath and then therefore has the obligation to meet that oath. And that is pretty amazing. We're not meeting God halfway. We're not meeting God partway. We're meeting God passively as he accomplishes what he says he is going to do. That is the foundation of the whole life of faith right here. Not what we do for God, but what God swears that he will do for us. Super important lesson. Abraham's side, there is no side. What does he do? Verse 6 says, then Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord counted that to him as righteousness, or as right standing with him. And this is why Abraham is so important to the biblical teaching of the life of faith, because he sets the real framework here for how all of God's people are called to relate to him. It's what he does for us, and our job is just to respond in faith to him. Let's take a look at what this means. And I want to think about it for us this evening in two ways. First, what does God seek? What was God looking for in Abram? Nothing other than personal trust in God's promises. That's all he was looking for. Was he saying, you know, Abram, you know, you're going to have to do a lot better job there, buddy. I expect a lot more monuments being raised up in my name. I expect all these other things. Nothing. Nothing at all. No works. No, nothing he does to make himself in any way acceptable to God. He simply believes what God promises to him. And it is this whole area then of trust that we see recurring throughout the biblical narrative when it comes to the life of faith. What does God really want? He doesn't want our performance. He doesn't want our religious gymnastics. He doesn't even really prioritize at the center of things our moral behavior. What he wants is our heart. He wants us to trust him. And that is supremely important to God. I am a parent. I'm a father, as some of you are, and some of you will be. And that what you realize is that what is important to me with this kid is not whether they're going to make mistakes or not, because guess what? They're going to. And some of those mistakes are going to be really significant and consequential. But what really matters in a love relationship is that softness of heart, that willingness to trust. And that is the precious thing that we seek in relationship, in intimate love relationships. And it's the same thing that God seeks in us. I think that so many of us come from these backgrounds where the thought of religion is such a mechanical and distant and obligatory exercise. There is, in one Christian tradition that is common in this country, the whole language is doing your obligations, which is going to church on Sunday mornings. And so, you know, it's just not there. It's really not the point. It's not about an obligation-based relationship. It's about a trust-based relationship. And the softness of Abram's heart, even though, and this is the key part, even though he had his doubts, even though he had fear, real fear, there was still a place in his heart for softness and trust in the promise and the oath of God. That is what God really seeks. It's the humility to receive a gift. You know, when God promises, that the other side of God's promises is that not only are you not obliged to do anything to earn it, but you can't do anything to earn it. And we will see in every chapter of Abraham's life as this narrative unfolds over the weeks ahead, that God purposely paints him in a place where only God has the capacity to fulfill his promises that he's made to Abraham. That's the point. It's not about how great Abraham was and look what I achieved. It's about the humility to receive a blessing, a promise from God. And that, I think, is very difficult because that applies to New Testament faith as well. God has something even greater than the promise that he made to Abraham for us. And that promise is reconciliation with God, with whom we are alienated. We are born into a broken world. We've chosen, each of us, to go our own way. And having gone our own way, which is not God's way, there's a barrier that separates ourselves from God. And there is nothing we can do to bridge that chasm. Nothing we can do to fill the gap. And so God is declaring to us that through Jesus Christ and through him alone, we can be reconciled to God. We can receive forgiveness from God. And for many of us, that's a hard lesson to take, because what does it mean? It means that I don't meet God halfway. We don't meet in the middle and swear oaths to each other. It doesn't matter how many good works I have. I mean, I may feel self-congratulatory and attaboy for not doing this or for doing the other thing or whatever. I'm not saying our moral behavior doesn't matter, but it doesn't affect our acceptability with God. Because that is only rooted in the promise that God makes, that if we entrust our lives to him, that he will forgive us of our guilt before him. That is the gospel. That is the good news. And that is why Abraham is such an important part of New Testament faith. And beyond that, not just the humility, but also the gratitude that comes from recognizing the goodness of God. That here are promises that God is making because he chooses to bless. How many times does God tell Abraham in his promise in chapter 12 that he will be the subject of God's blessing? 4 times. It's significant. And why is it significant? Because that too is a part of faith, because it captures real trust in who God is. God is good. I love the way the author of Hebrews defines faith. He puts it like this. He says, it is impossible to please God without faith. Okay, so we'll just stop right there. It's impossible to please God without faith. And then he says, those who come to God must believe that he is and that he rewards those who seek him. So both of these things are very important. The act of humility to bow to a holy God and receive forgiveness that we could never earn ourselves. And then to thank him that his will for us is good, that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Both of these things are super important to the life of faith. I was talking to a friend that I've been interacting with about Christ for several months now. And we get together and we go to the rusty old Bucket of Nails there on State Street and get a booth and put the Bible open. It's an interesting juxtaposition of experiences there. But we've been talking about God and how he has revealed himself in the scriptures and how we can know that these things are true. And we have talked that through, and we met together last week, and he said to me, I have no more questions. None. About the truth of Christianity, I'm convinced. And I said, well, that's awesome. Are you ready to receive the forgiveness that he's freely offering you? He said, oh, no. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah, I have my reservations. I said, I know your reservations. Your reservations are that if you make this decision, you fear that you're going to end up being like someone that you don't respect, that you don't want to be. You're afraid that you're going to lose yourself in making this decision, aren't you? And he said, yeah, that's exactly it. I'm like, okay. Let's think about this passage right here. He is a rewarder of those who seek him. What does that mean? What that means is that whatever God's intent and God's purpose for your life is, it is rooted in the fact that he seeks to give you reward. The same God who was prepared to enter into human history to die on your behalf, to demonstrate his unconditional love for you. If he has a will and purpose for your life, surely it will be reflected in his generosity that he's already shown to you. Yeah, that's true. That's good. Good point. Good point. Yeah, and how about the fact, too, that these noble and legitimate desires that you have, the kind of higher aspirations that you have as a man, that you know that you're unable to realize because why? Because you're a broken man. How about what about the fact that God in your life would give you the motivation and the power to become this person that you know he wants you to be already? How about that? Yeah, that's different. That's an important part of this conversation, because everyone who is far from God has 2 problems. One is their pride that keeps God at a distance. We don't want to receive anything, even if it's from the God of the universe. And second, I don't want to become somebody that I don't respect and don't want to be like. And it is very important that we are able to speak truth to those concerns. And this is the kind of thing that we see in the narrative of Abraham. Well, let's press on. God, in seeing the faith of Abram, counts it to him as righteousness, as it says. Righteousness simply means right standing before God. And this comes right to the center of the biblical message. In Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, it simply says, by grace you have been saved. What is grace? Grace is God's gift to you. Grace is God's generosity to you. Grace is God's promise. It has everything to do with Him and nothing to do with you. Our salvation has nothing to do with us and everything to do with God. We've been saved. We've been reconciled with God. We've been forgiven. We've been made alive by God. Not by our own efforts, but by faith. It is not of yourselves, he says, it is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one can boast. No one can boast. You see. And that is New Testament faith rooted deeply in the soil of the first book of the Old Testament. This has always been God's way of dealing with people. Right standing with God is not about our merits. It is about our trust in the promises of God to us. Now, let's apply this. How does it work? How does this life of faith work? And I want to just touch on three things that we see in this narrative. The first is the obvious. How does it work? It works imperfectly. What kind of faith do we have? Not great faith. What kind of faith did Abraham have? Half-hearted faith. How is it that the same guy in two verses separated from each other can on the one hand say, Abram believed, and on the other hand say, how may I know? You ever thought about that? What does it mean about the level of faith that this guy really had? He did trust, but at the same time, he's like, but. And our faith is just replete with but clauses. I believe, but I trust you, but I'm sure this is true, but I'll follow you, but, and it's all these buts going around. Yeah. Ask Hagar in chapter 16 how clearly Abraham really got it. Or Abimelech in chapter 20. Abraham is our model of faith, but he is by no means perfect. His faith is incredibly imperfect, as we will see in narrative after narrative after narrative. I really like one of my favorite verses is Mark 9, verse 24, where this broken man pleads with Jesus to heal his son. And Jesus is like, well, you know, it takes faith. And he just had this incredible sincerity. And he says, I do believe, help my unbelief. I believe, help my unbelief. In my heart, I do trust you, but then I got my butt clauses. I've never seen anything like this before. I'm really worried about my son. We've got all this kind of stuff going on. And so I believe, but my belief is far from perfect. Help my unbelief. And Christ, of course, did that. In Hebrews 12, verse 1, it says, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses. And now he's referring to Abraham and all these people in the book of Genesis that he has singled out because they're examples of faith. He says, since we have this cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race set before us. You know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And the life of faith is a life of ups and downs, and we are going to meet failure, and we're going to meet setbacks, and we're going to find ourselves at points in crises of faith. And is our faith imperfect? You bet it is. And that's okay. Okay? It's important that you realize all of these great heroes of faith in the Old Testament, and David is pointed to, and Moses is pointed to, and Abraham is pointed to, and these are deeply, deeply flawed people with very flawed faith, but there is something in them. A softness. Where they're prepared, even in their dark moments, in their confusion, to trust God. That is the commonality that they share. Abraham believed was an active dependence. It's true that it's all about what God has done, but then he calls us to a certain kind of action, and that action is not to change the equation where it's part my work, part God's. That's not the life of faith, but it is to place myself in dependence upon Him against my urgings to go my own way and do my own thing. I like what it says at the very beginning of our story. It says in verse 1, "Do not fear, Abram, for," he says, "I am a shield to you." A shield. A shield doesn't do very much good if it's just laying on the ground, right? You saw Braveheart and 300, and, you know, shields are really important. But you've got to put a shield up, and you got to go like this, right? It doesn't mean that you are the shield. It just simply means that you're allowing yourself the protection that the shield offers. That's the point. I am a shield to you, Abram. God is our shield, and we need to place ourselves under His protection. There's this beautiful statement as this very scene is recaptured in the book of Hebrews, chapter 6. The author of Hebrews says, when God made the promise to Abraham, He swore by Himself, since there is no greater name. Interesting. Then He swore an oath. So you've got Genesis 12 promise and Genesis 15 oath. So that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement and hope. And what beautiful language that is. He's saying we sit between two fundamental certainties, the promise of God and the oath, the covenant that He enters into. And it is in relation to these things that are certain. Why are they certain? Because the Lord God swore by His own name to do these things. That, He says, you can take refuge in. You can take refuge in that. It's an active dependence to say, I believe that these promises that you've made to me, these things are true, and I am prepared to take relevant action on the basis of that, which means first that we're making a reasonable choice. It was reasonable for Abraham, even though his faith was broken and conflicted, it was reasonable for him to trust God, because he had seen the provision of God. He had seen the blessing of God in his life. He had seen the release of his nephew Lot from their captors. And so he had reason to know that these things were true. But there is a choice involved, and you'll never feel your way into faith. You'll never feel your way into faith. Faith is a consideration of the information that God brings to us. Is it exhaustive information? Of course not. How could it be? How could you ever understand exhaustive truths about the nature of God, His purposes in the world, and such things? We get enough information. We get enough information so that we can make a faith choice to entrust our lives to the promises that God gives to us. And that is the way it is for every single thing that we do in life. I remember thinking those years ago with my soon-to-be wife. I love her. I really want to get married to her. And am I sure that this will work out? Well, I am in love. But I know myself. And I know her, and I know things don't always work out. And so it's like, you get that. There's a choice. You make that choice. It's a reasonable choice. I'm grateful for that choice. 35 years later, it's still okay. Now, God is calling on you to make a choice, a faith choice, to trust what He has offered you in Christ. And He has given you sufficient information, not exhaustive information. And He's saying, will you trust me enough to make that choice? That's all I'm asking. And I think that's really a big part of this whole thing. And then we ask this question, okay, so what do I do today? What do I need to do today to be one who learns to really take refuge in God, to really learn what does it mean to trust in His promises? How do I do that? Here's a great psalm for you. Psalm 5, verse 3 says, "Oh, in the morning, O Lord, you will hear my voice. In the morning, I order my prayer to you." And then he says, "I eagerly watch." Okay, both of those things are very important. We're paired together. I pray, and then I watch. With real expectation, I say, "God, help me to see you at work in the people that I'm interacting with at work today, in my neighborhood, with whatever, so that I can become a player in what you're trying to accomplish." You know what? I'm telling you that 100% of the time, God will answer that prayer. That we will find an opportunity if our heart is soft before God, to be led by Him, to see things from His vantage point that enable us to move toward people, to move toward situations, and to see the hand of God work in our lives. But we say to ourselves, you know, here's why I doubt, here's why my faith is so lame, it's just I never see anything, right? Well, this will change that. In a very fundamental way, this will change that. I don't care how little faith you have, and maybe it's not much, and that's going to be okay. But will you do what the psalmist says? Will you come before God with all of the limitations of your faith and say, "I don't have a lot of faith, God, but I'm presenting myself to you today. I believe that you are at work in the world, and I would love to see in my little part of that world what you are doing. And so I'm going to watch in real faith. I'm going to watch to see what you're doing, and I want to move toward that." And I'm just telling you that that is what enables us to see the hand of God. It's not complicated. It's not difficult. Anyone can do it. And this will build your faith. Pray and watch. Pray and watch. It's just like that. Lastly, there is a result. Okay? Lives change when we're prepared to take that step of trust in God. And so, we go back to the same passage that applies this narrative from the Old Testament in Hebrews chapter 6, verses 18 and 19. He says, when he swore an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it's impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge, he says, have strong encouragement and hope. And then I love the language in verse 19. This hope we have as an anchor for the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast. An anchor for the soul. How many of you have been out on the water in a little boat and you're getting pounded here and pounded there and you're trying to fish, but the freaking boat keeps floating away and you got all these problems? And you're like, "Man, this is just like my life. I need an anchor." Yeah, you do need an anchor. We all need an anchor. What grounds you? What grounds you? What keeps you in place? What enables you to stand your ground against the adversities of life that you will undoubtedly face? You're going to be blown around by a lot of things in this world. You're going to encounter the frailties of old age and sickness and dying in yourself and everyone that you care about. You're going to see all manner of disappointments in the plans that you have, some of which will succeed and others, many others perhaps will not. You're going to see people disappoint you. You're going to find your agenda not working out. There are lots of things in your life that have the ability to just utterly erode your faith. But here's the thing. What's your anchor? What's your anchor? What holds you in place? And I think this is one of the real pretty critical, important questions of life right here. And my plea is that, you know, the world offers us false anchors, anchors that are way too light for the kind of weight that we need to really keep our life in place. And we are called upon to build agendas around financial security and national security and the protection of my little bubble. We're very security conscious in this way. And we talk about the real fulfillment that will come when I meet just that right person or have that right job or whatever it is. And I'm here to tell you that none of that works. Not that any of those are bad things, I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is they're not the right thing. They're not the central thing. They're not the anchor. And is your life adrift? Maybe you know that your life's adrift. Maybe you sense it in the trail of broken relationships behind you, your inability to connect on a deep level with people, and just there's something missing, there's something wrong. And that pervasive sense of just not stacking up and failure and a pervading sense of guilt or shame about your life or just chronic disappointment. These are things that tell us something, that we feel pain because pain is a wake-up call to alert us to something deeper. What is the problem? The problem is that we are far from God. That's the problem. And the only solution to that problem is to respond to the promises that God has made to us in Christ. To come alive to Him spiritually, to know Him in that intimate way where we trust Him and what He has done on the cross on our behalf. And then to begin to live a life of taking incremental steps forward, to pray and watch, to pray and watch, and begin to see the reality, the water clearing. We can see that anchor with such much more clarity, and we're not moving around like we once were, and we feel a sense of stability that we've never had before. And that's the life of faith. And that's what God wants for each one of us. He's asking you, what were you going to do? What will you do tonight? What will you do tomorrow? To trust in His promises, to root that life of faith deeply in the soil of His promises to you. That's the real issue here. And then we're going to apply this in the weeks ahead to all manner of challenges that come before Abraham and see the victory of faith fought through many battles of failure. So there we go. I've said about as much as I'm going to say.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.